Checkerfin.
Fordham is always in my head.
Checkerfin. Checkerfin.
Yes.
It's the education gadfly
sex,
show.
Sex.
Mike and Rick tell you
early college, high school, pain and suffering, in your face, in your face,
your
face.
Listen to your words that they be preaching, cause here's the education gadfly show. Yeah. It's the education gadfly.
Hello, this is your host Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, here with my co-host, a man who is surging in the Iowa primaries, Rick Hess.
Hey, Mikey.
How are you today?
I'm doing good. Apparently, I'm surging.
You are surging.
Surging and surging.
Yeah, that's right. So you had a big meeting yesterday, understand, with a bunch of youngish scholars. Tell us about that.
Yeah, we put together a working group of a bunch of interesting kind of multidisciplinary scholars from around the country. And then some of the folks doing interesting stuff in reform, whether it's Michelle Rhee or, you know, a variety of other folks. And just trying to see if we can't figure out ways to tackle some of the questions and ask some of the research questions that don't usually get asked because they're too difficult and too thorny. In fact, I believe Fordham is trying something along these lines with that noted empiricist Tom Lovelace this coming year on the question of gifted ed.
Well, that is very true. We have a big kickoff in that today.
No kidding.
Well,
there
kidding.
You go. How fortuitous.
But speaking of surging, you got, you know, education finally making some inroads into the campaign this week. Yesterday, Mike Huckabee and Mitt Romney debated who had the stronger education record.
Yes, one of the more insightful exchanges. I don't believe you, sir, have the strongest record of the nation's governors. Ooh.
Yes, but I'm sure that Ed&08 will claim this as a great success. That their $60 million campaign is paying off.
Well, what's also interesting is Iraq has now fallen dramatically in terms of voters' number one interest.
Yeah.
No evidence that education is moving up in the gap. It's economy. Right. It's healthcare. That's
yes.
So it goes.
Yep. All right. Well, got a lot to cover today. We're going to, of course, play a game of Pardon the Gadfly. Then we have an interview with Tom Lovelace, whose new Brown Center report on education came out this week. And finally, we'll hear from Liam, who will impart some education news of the weird.
That's an action-packed day, baby.
Action-packed. Let's get started. Kobe is filling in for Christina today. So, Kobe, let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
Okay, let's do it.
Come on, Kobe, get pumped up. I don't feel like you're excited enough.
Our listeners may not know this, but it's 9:30 a.m. right now.
That's
not usual for us.
That's right. It's true. We usually do this in the afternoon so that we can have a happy hour be involved in.
Yes.
All right. The original education gadfly, Checker Finn, has a piece in this week's Gadfly and in the Columbus Dispatch making sense of the disappointing performance of Ohio's charter schools. One problem, he argues, is talent. It's hard to get great teachers or administrators to move to Ohio, and the local talent is sometimes lacking. Rick, how do we get great people into education, not just in popular cities like San Francisco, but in out-of-the-way places like Dayton?
First off, Kobe, you got to step it up. When Christina reads these things, there's energy, there's panache. Dude, I feel somnambulant. Right now, I'm like trying to muster the energy to respond to your query.
I know, and he was a DJ in college. He talks about this all the time.
You know what he did? He did those 3 a.m. He's like, and it's Kobe with a late night. Great. Anyway.
Quiet storm.
So, look, first off, I'm not sure that the optimal strategy for Checker to be building enthusiasm about Dayton charter schools is to be complaining in the Ohio papers about how nobody likes to be in Dayton. I'm just saying. Anyway, but that's just neither here nor there. The real issue here is that it's true that when we talk about education entrepreneurship and education leadership, we're trying to get people to go to 15,000 districts, 90,000 schools scattered across the country. When you're doing that in high tech, you're not trying to get people in Oklahoma and Ohio. That stuff's concentrated in Boston and Washington, D.C. and Austin and Seattle and Silicon Valley, which makes it much easier to recruit. On the other hand, fact is that just means we got to be smarter and more aggressive. And there's a lot of interest in trying to do things, obviously, in the K-12 space.
But see, didn't you just contradict yourself? I mean, because I do feel like, you know, you and lots of other people out there in the education space make a big deal out of, you know, the Teach for Americas and the New Teacher Project and some of these other initiatives, which are akin to getting entrepreneurs to Silicon Valley. I mean, if we're not going to be able to get people to move to Dayton or to move to Ohio, don't we have to do a much better job of getting the latent talent that's there to be interested in going to teaching and help them do a better job? In other words, we can't think about getting entrepreneurial people like we would, you know, say for a McKinsey accounting company. I mean, we got to get people who are there on the ground mm-hmm. and who just want to be good teachers.
Yes. And we got to make it easier for them to be good teachers. We got to create environments and give them tools to make it easier. Absolutely. But on the other thing is you can be much smarter about the whole recruitment effort, both people already there. So I'm thinking big billboards with Checker, two thumbs up, a big smile, saying come and serve Ohio's kids. That's the kind of aggressive marketing that we don't get enough of.
Nice, nice. Okay, Kobe, second topic.
Mike, New York Times columnist Michael Weinrip,
woo!
Citing a recent ETS study, argues that low student achievement is not schools' fault. The study found that factors outside of schools' control, such as watching television, can predict a state's student achievement. But is student absenteeism and TV watching really outside schools' control? Is Weinrip right that we should focus on societal issues like family leave instead of school reform?
Excellent questions, Kobe. Wow, that was much better. That had some energy, some verve. Steph,
this is your point about Ohio. You're right. We just turned Kobe from a mediocre kind of question announcer into a top, in a 45-second kind of
That's right. Because a minute ago, I thought I was going to need to go out and recruit somebody more entrepreneurial.
But no need. You just stepped up his game.
I love it.
This is what we need to do in the Daytons and the Columbuses.
I like it. So, yeah, so Michael Weinrip, in an article reminiscent of this year's Education Week Quality Counts, remember their Chance for Success Index, where their motto was "Demography is Destiny." It's
I don't think that was the official motto.
No, it's not. No. That was a little swipe at your friend Chris Swanson. But who was included in your group?
Indeed, he was.
Okay, though, even though nobody here Fordham was included in your group, I'm not bitter. No, but you know, so here it is.
Says the man who excluded AEI is the only think tank excluded from the Fordham Fellows Program. But let's not get
tit for tat. So Mike Ryan, you know, so here we go. Michael Weinrip, another New York Times columnist, making the case that, you know, it's not school's fault. The kids aren't learning anything. It all has to do with family background. Now, of course, family background matters a lot. We know that a whole, you know, we've known that forever. But you look at the study that he cites, this ETS study, and indeed, they say that things like student absenteeism are outside school's control. I just don't believe that that is the case. If you have a school like KIPP or Amistad, and they have kids who are not showing up, they're going to go find out what's going on. They're going to drag those kids to school if they have to. He also talks about, you know, TV watching at night. Again, if you assign enough homework and hold kids responsible for it, they're not going to have time to watch TV.
No, that's right. I mean, and then when we talk about the background factors, there's two ways to talk about it. There's the Richard Rothstein kind of socioeconomic structures, and that's we need national policies like family leave to address this. But there's also the softer question of responsible parenting. And one of the things that, you know, that the KIPPs and the Amistads and, you know, the big picture companies, what these do is they go out and they aggressively seek responsible adults. They get them involved in the school and they work with families and they create expectations and pressures. Private schools have been doing this forever. It's, you know, inadequate to let not just educators, but folks in the community off the hook when it comes to irresponsible parenting.
Okay. Nice. Kobe's not irresponsible. He has stepped up his game. What is topic number three?
Topic three. Ossining, New York. I hope I'm pronouncing that right.
Awesome. Ossining.
A less wealthy area of Westchester County is trying to confront the achievement gap by, among other things, starting school clubs specifically for black males. Rick, is this type of segregation a good way to make positive change?
Ooh, here's a thorny one. Look. If actually, in the abstract, I'm fine with these kinds of things if we're going to let different folks play by these rules. If we're going to let evangelical student groups use the school facilities to have meetings, if we're going to make it possible for, you know, all male schools to operate, for, you know, if we are going to apply these same rules across the board and be comfortable with kind of the implications of pluralism, I'm okay with it. However, it seems that we are persistently and consistently not okay with this in most cases, and in fact, quite accusatory towards those who would actually organize these groups. But then for certain, you know, for certain populations, we turn around and we are comfortable kind of creating a different set of rules. So I'm okay with this if we are going to allow these rules to be applied across the board to to organizations which have a constructive purpose and which, you know, in which one can make a plausible case for why they're useful. But I'm not okay with only doing it for black boys or only doing it for Muslim students and not permitting those same rules to be applied to others.
Yeah, I think that's right. And one question is whether or not this is working. I guess so far there hasn't been any evidence that it's been terribly successful in terms of getting black male students to, you know, improve their academic achievement or college going rates or that sort of thing. Maybe some of the these kinds of programs would help. I mean, what they're trying to do is to figure out a way, you know, to change the culture of a school so that it's okay for black boys to do well academically and not to be ostracized. That seems like a, you know, a reasonable goal, but it should be judged then on that merit. Are you achieving that goal or not?
You know, it's part of the single sex conversation. It's, you know, they tried to do these Afrocentric schools in Detroit back in the early mid 90s, and they got hit by the ACLU and others worried about, you know, a variety of issues. So, you know, part of this is just a question of people keep changing kind of what's the permissible ground rules and the permissible conversation.
Right.
And I'm like, look, let's agree on what we want schools to do and then apply those rules fairly.
Okay. All right. Well, we are lucky today to have with us Tom Lovelace, who is the director of the Brown Center on Education Policy. Is that what we call it?
That's it.
At the Brookings Institution. Tom, welcome to the Education Gadfly Show.
Thank you. My second appearance. This time you can hear me.
That's right. We should play a tape of the last appearance early in the days.
I was Kenny on South Park.
Right. Right. In fact, we could do the imitation. It was...
But, you know, I will say though, Tom, that we had to do a call with you last time because you come into your office so infrequently that we couldn't have you in the studio.
I'm trying to change that from just coming into basically any office less frequently.
Okay, well, Tom, so new report out. This is your annual report, or I guess sometimes, some years you...
No, it's annual.
It's the annual, okay. Yeah. Oh, it's your conference that's...
It's our seventh edition.
Your seventh edition. All right, wow. So give us the highlights. What's the big news out of this one?
Well, we did three studies. The first one was on NAEP proficiency levels, and I basically concluded that they are set too high on performance levels and that the proficiency cut point is too high. And that was based in part on international data that Gary Phillips analyzed, and he mapped TIM scores onto NAEP performance levels. And he found out, for instance, that in Japan, eighth graders in mathematics, only 57% would meet our standard for proficiency. So you have 43% of Japanese eighth graders left behind if you buy that. I don't buy that.
Tom, isn't this the soft bigotry of low expectations for Japanese youth?
Yes, I think that's right. I think that's right.
No, but let me ask you about this, though, Tom. I mean, so you say that they're too high. Isn't another, in part because you say that now No Child Left Behind has this goal of 100% proficiency, but can't we turn this on its head and say that maybe the goal of 100% proficiency is what's wrong? I mean, what's wrong with having an aspirational standard that's set very high, and maybe you know that, look, we're only going to get 60 or 70% of our kids to that standard?
There's nothing wrong with that. We just have to be honest about the aspirational standard. I mean, we could have as a standard or as a goal calculus for all kindergartners, but chances are we're not going to get there. So what we've done with proficiency, unfortunately, in sort of the public discourse, is we've defined, and you see this now in journalistic accounts, when people talk about kids reaching proficiency, if they don't, they say they failed. Mm-hmm. And that's what the rhetoric is, including by researchers. The whole race to the bottom stuff. Yeah. Some people in this room have done work on this.
And we've said that there's a walk to the middle, not a race to the bottom.
Yeah.
But come on, Tom. In most states, if you do not get to proficiency on most state tests, you have failed. I mean, because the proficient bar is set so low.
The NAEP is actually an easier test. You see, we're in a bizarre Alice in Wonderland situation. Mm-hmm. The NAEP test is dominated. I'm talking about eighth grade math now.
Yeah.
The eighth grade test is dominated by whole number arithmetic. What we do is we take whole number arithmetic at the eighth grade. We trick it up to make it more difficult by presenting them as word problems. Then the kids... So kids do fail that once you do that. Then we set a proficiency cut point so high that a very small percentage passed that test. So we have a test that's too easy. We have it presented in such a way where kids are going to miss the items. Mm-hmm. And then we set the performance levels at an unreasonable level. So it really does need reform.
Okay,
it's a bad measure.
All right. So and tell quickly about the other two studies.
The other two studies, the second study, we looked at private school enrollment data over a century. And just I just posed the question, there's this interesting phenomenon where for the last 50 years, we've been hearing so much about how private schools are better than public schools, and there's a lot of social science research that indicates that may be true. Also, public opinion data shows that people believe that private schools mm-hmm. are better, and yet private school enrollment's been declining since mm-hmm. 1960. So we examine that. And then the third part looks at a very simple question. If you increase instructional time, do kids do better in the subject? So this is looking at international data. Now, this sounds, you know, like a no-brainer, right? If you study math more, you should score higher in math. The interesting thing is that researchers have been looking at this for 30 years, and the correlations actually are neutral. You can't find international evidence that increasing instructional time in math increases test scores in math. What we did, however, is not look at cross-sectional data. We looked at changes in time over time, and we correlated that with changes in test scores over time, and we found a positive relationship. So it's nice that common sense sometimes is borne out by data.
How strong is that relationship, Tom?
The correlation coefficient was statistically significant, and there are a couple of outliers. Norway and Sweden both were outliers in the data. If you pull them out, the relationship becomes pretty strong. Now, again, this is correlation, so you can't claim causality, but the prior analyses were also correlational. So.
All right. Well, Tom, I don't understand why you didn't get more press on this. I should have seen the headline in New York Times. Spend more time on math, test scores go up.
There you go.
That should have been right there. You were robbed.
Oh, one more thing. We did disentangle. There are two ways of increasing instructional time. You can increase the calendar year by adding days, or you can increase the minutes in a day. And we found that increasing the minutes in a day, you get much more bang for the buck, about twice as much.
Yeah, very interesting. All right. Well, Tom, it is a pleasure, and it's so nice to be able to actually hear you this time. Tom Lovelace from the Brookings Institution. Thanks for joining us. Okay, well, it is that time. It is the time that we wait for all week long. It is Education News of the Weird Time. With our weird correspondent, Liam Julian. Liam, what is weird this week?
It's weird enough that Mike Huckabee calls his volunteers, quote, Huck's Army. It's even weirder that perhaps one quarter of that army are composed of homeschoolers and their parents. The LA Times reports that homeschoolers, because of their flexible schedules, are some of the most sought-after campaign workers from the Times, quote, in the evenings, families pile into minivans to canvass door-to-door. Parents often send their children to make the pitch, so the whole experience becomes part of their education like a civics class come to life, unquote. And this is nothing new. Longtime Illinois Republican legislator Penny Pullen said an 11-year-old homeschooled boy was her best precinct captain ever, wearing down undecided voters with his enthusiasm and energy. Rick, this is a little weird, right?
Yep.
And that's Education News of the Weird.
I don't know. What do you think? I remember that there was some controversy earlier this year when under 18-year-olds were making campaign donations. The question was whether or not their parents were just getting around campaign finance laws by writing the checks in their name so they could give more to candidates. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I don't know. Is that okay? Is this kind of campaigning on behalf of kids okay?
These are good questions.
You know, do you have an answer?
when I was teaching down in Baton Rouge, when I was teaching high school social studies, was during the David Duke's gubernatorial campaign against Edwin Edwards when the slogan was vote for the crook over the bigot. I think that more or less that was it, or maybe vote for the crook over the Nazi. I can't remember exactly, but. You know, one of the interesting things was I thought it'd be neat to, you know, require my students to volunteer 2 or 3 hours for a campaign of their choice and then write about that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just kind of see how that operation worked up close. And it was funny. The principal in the district said in theory, that was fine. But because of Duke's involvement, they didn't want to have a situation where anybody was volunteering in the Duke campaign.
Risk-averse school districts.
There's all kinds of complexity, you know, which is not an unreasonable stance on their part.
Yeah, yeah.
But I got to say, I mean, there's all kinds of complexities here when we start to think about how do you think about the role of engagement in these things as part of an education?
Well, they should have paired this with a look at how many of the Democrats' volunteers are teachers. You know, because it's long been known that teachers make great volunteers as well,
yes.
Especially in Iowa, where they're going to be off for Christmas break leading up to the primaries. They're going to have all kinds of time, and, you know, they're very effective in this role as well. So it looks like you're going to have the teachers versus the homeschoolers out there dueling it out. Mm. Or actually, it'll be the homeschoolers on the Republican side, I guess, and the teachers on the Democrat side.
Yeah. With Oprah.
Interesting. You should write a piece about that.
There you go.
All right. Well, that is all the time we have for this week. It's been fun.
It's been good.
We should keep doing this.
And Tom is top shelf. We got to have him back more often when we can hear him.
Very insightful.
He's a pro. You can tell he's polished.
Uh-huh.
You can tell the man's done this a lot.
He's even been on television.
He has.
Yeah.
As of you.
Yeah. Well, that's right.
You can always tell the quality thing.
All right. Well, until next time,
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, signing off.